Average age in here is probably about half the age of what I used to in Washington, D.C. I go to a lot of Council on Foreign Relations and Brookings and CSIS events, and by this time of night, most of them are asleep. So I hope to not put you to sleep, that's for sure. James talked a little bit about my background, but I'm going to just touch on that for a second and then talk about the American Security Project and then talk about American competitiveness. I did do 30 years in the Marines from 1971 to a little over 2001. A lot of time in the Pentagon, a lot of time in New York at the Council on Foreign Relations. So I was kind of on the policy side. I ended my tenure in the Marine Corps as the commanding general at the Marine Corps Recruit Depot in Parris Island. Out of that, though, I got into the nonprofit business, thanks in part to the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, D.C., and I worked for an organization called the Business Executives for National Security. Did some prep school work, was president of a school for 5 years. Then came back when Senator Kerry asked me if I would take over the American Security Project. And the American Security Project was formed in 2006, and it was a spinoff from the 2004 election. And he and Senator Hagel and Senator Hart and Senator Rubin were particularly upset that if they brought up certain issues, they got painted one way or the other, far right or far left, in most cases far left, and it became such a political hot topic that you couldn't talk about it rationally. Among those issues were climate change, nuclear security, energy security, and American competitiveness. You can imagine a lot of times when you talk climate change, that's not a nice topic among the Tea Partiers and the far right. And I can give examples here of some of those who have brought that topic up in political forums or in front of their primaries and been defeated, not the least of which was Bob Inglis down in South Carolina. So the intent behind the American Security Project was to put a think tank together, not a robust organization, but a small one that would study each one of these topics and do nonpartisan or bipartisan research on them, come out with facts and figures supporting whatever our stance would be on each one of those issues, and hopefully provide that to either side, one or the other, so that when it came up in a political argument, they could stand up and say, hey, I understand what the people on the far right are saying or the far left. Here's the facts and here's the figures on each one of these topics. And so we've done a lot of work on each one of those issues over the last 5 or 6 years. And I'll just touch a little bit on some of them. Energy security, I was fortunate enough to spend the afternoon over at MIT at their fusion lab, and we tend to think that fusion is the future of energy security in this country, in that if you put enough research into it, the technology is there, the science is there, the technology will get up to it, and we'll have a ready source of energy. It's those types of things looking to the future and way in the future, 10, 20 years. Also, on the energy side of the house, while we don't like fossil fuels, we understand our dependence on it. We need to get off of fossil fuels. We need to get off of the in this place into climate change, we need to get off the pollution aspect of it. So we think there ought to be alternative ways of getting away from fossil fuels. Biofuels is just one of those. There are electricity, of course, hybrids, those types of things. I mentioned earlier to somebody else in the audience, isn't it amazing that last year we drilled more oil in this country in the last year than we did in any single year of the last 15, yet when you pull up to the pump, what do you think the price is? It's the highest you've ever seen. And the point to that is we will never drill our way to energy independence. It just will not happen. So we've got to get off this oil addiction one way or the other, and we put out a number of papers on that aspect. On nuclear security, we are not a no-nuke organization. I think it would be great if there were no nuclear weapons in this world, and I imagine a fair portion of you feel the same way. Unfortunately, that's not realistic today. Russia has thousands, as we do. We tend to think that is way overkill. We were instrumental in helping getting New START passed 2 years ago. If you're not familiar, New START lowered the number of nuclear weapons that are on alert per country, Russia and the United States, to 1,550. And when you think about that, 1,550 nuclear weapons, and on average, each one of those has five times the power of the Fat Man bomb dropped in Hiroshima. It's a little bit of overkill, I would suspect. So we tend to think that number could be dropped by as much as 1,000, if not more. Again, it's another topic. It has come up. The president mentioned it in his State of the Union address. It's a hot topic with some far-right Republicans. There's a monetary savings here when you do that. We are spending billions a year, literally, to keep that arsenal updated. But that's not why we're here to talk today. We're here to talk about American competitiveness and national security. It's been a big topic with the American Security Project, and big enough that we employed this young lad sitting next to me, August Cole, to write what we think is a significant paper on this exact topic, and this is what cover sheet of it looks like. If you've not read it, you can go on our website, AmericanSecurityProject.org, and it lines out in quite some detail, and I think August will get into it a lot more in depth than I will, about how we feel about American competitiveness. But I'm sure it's no surprise to anybody here, we're slipping in this country. And any statistics you want to use, whether it be education rates, which are a big one, graduation rates, we're 27th in the world in graduation rates with those who have science or engineering degrees. In global competitiveness, on the World Economic Forum has listed us 7th place. We were number one in 2009. We have some great problems with our competitiveness, and it's affecting our national security. We're losing influence, and people are going to stop investing. I'm sure you're familiar with the bond rate. Bond rate has dropped from AAA to AA+. And a lot of this is tied into 6 topics that August has listed here. But, August, I'm going to boil them down. You listed 6. I'm going to put down 3. And I'm going to say it's economy, it's people, and it's infrastructure. Now, the 6 he listed, on the economy side, there's business climate, there's national debt, and in defense industrial base, which also plays into the people side of the house. And on the people side, labor market and immigration and education and health care. No surprise to anybody here when you look at what's going on the economy side of the house. What's kind of interesting, though, when you look at the stock market and how it's just gone crazy the last couple of months. We're facing a real problem here in about 9 days with sequestration. And it's been a hot topic. I mentioned earlier that Secretary Kerry and hopefully Secretary Hagel were 2 founders of our organization. I think Senator Hagel will get confirmed here next week. It's been ugly, and it's really been nasty in D.C. I don't know how that's appeared up here in Boston. That's certainly been the way it's been in our way, and it's been a political charade, in my opinion. But he will get confirmed, and then they'll swear him in, like, the next day, and then 2 days later, it's going to be sequestration. And what sequestration is doing is a 10% whack off the federal budget, right off of the Department of Defense budget. And there's no discretion. I mean, they've got to just take it across the board. And therein lies the big problem with sequestration. I like to say they're taking an axe. What he really needs to be allowed to do is take a scalpel. I'm not saying there's fat in the defense budget. There is fat in the defense budget. But there are programs that are good that need to stay and not be cut. There are some that are perhaps not as good that he can cut, but you need to give him that flexibility. But I'm not sure he's going to get there because they're going to play one-upsmanship until March 1st. And then we'll, just like the fiscal cliff, or maybe unlike the fiscal cliff, we went over it and then they pushed it downstream the next day. I'm not sure that's going to happen this time. The whole world is watching this whole evolution occur. And they're thinking, here's this country, this rich country, who's been the best country economically for decades now, can't even handle its own finances. And it's impacting our reputation worldwide, and people are going to understand that. Certainly a little bit on the defense side, I'm sure you've seen all the service chiefs come up and say, it's affected how we're going to train, because the operations and maintenance budgets are the quickest ones that they can cut, that it'll affect their deployments. And that's being watched overseas. And they're thinking, boy, they can't even deploy their soldiers, sailors, and Marines, given their budget problems. So we need to fix the economy side of the house. And that's not an easy thing to do, given the partisan nature of what's going on inside Washington, D.C. We can't even pass a budget in Washington, D.C. But we need to really come to grips with that and the national debt. And August, I know you quoted in your paper Admiral Mullen's comment, the number one threat to our national security is our national debt, and it just keeps exploding. We need to get a handle on that. We need to get a handle on the entitlement side of the House. But it's really disappointing and hard to see when you look at what's going on with Senator Hagel and the confirmation hearings and that whole business. They can hardly agree on anything. Which leads me into people and education and immigration reform. Perhaps, the one issue that they can agree on would be immigration reform. We're some 230,000-plus people short with graduate degrees in science, technology, engineering, math in this country. We will never make up that shortfall, certainly not in the near term. Yet, we continue to educate immigrants in all those disciplines and then send them back home. we don't give them a visa. We don't. We can't keep them here. It's absurd. I mean, it's just ridiculous. Why would we not keep that talent that we've trained here? And I will tell you, and I think no surprise to anyone here, a fair portion of them want to stay here, but we won't give them the visas to do it. Now, I think there's an intersection here on the Democrat and Republican side that might be one of the issues that they can finally come to grips with here in this next session of Congress and get something passed. At least I hope so. Jan and I were having a conversation earlier about primary education and secondary education. I spent 5 years as the president of a prep school in Texas. I can tell you there are huge problems with our primary education in this country. Certainly when you're only graduating 75% of the students that enter, a 25% plus dropout rate, that has to be fixed and has to be worked on. We're just not educating our youngsters to the way they need to be educated, let alone to get into college. I love the statistic, and I'll betray a confidence here, but I read it in USA Today yesterday. Johnny Manziel, who won the Heisman this year, who's a freshman at Texas A&M, this semester is taking 4 courses. They're all online, and it's in sports management. So I have a very good friend of mine who's the vice president for student affairs at Texas A&M, and I happened to send him that quote, and he was pretty embarrassed by it. I mean, it's just a slight indication of what's going on in some of our education system here in this country, and it's going downhill, and we need to come to grips with that business. On the infrastructure side of the house, it's no surprise to anybody here either. We are woefully inadequate on infrastructure, ranked 20th out of 144 countries in the world in terms of infrastructure. The power grid, you're familiar with that, the roads, they're all falling apart. Here's another opportunity, I think, for Congress to work together and perhaps have a situation where they can employ people to fix our infrastructure, loan companies to get them built, and there'll be a payback and hopefully improve our infrastructure. But that's another one that's a real vulnerability for this country. And that's not — other countries are watching this. They're saying, how can they not fix their own infrastructure? And we've not been able to do that. So I'll get off my horse here for a while and turn it over to August here for a second. But there are indeed big problems that need to be fixed. I'm not particularly optimistic on any of them, except maybe the infrastructure or immigration side of the house. Maybe there's a little hope on infrastructure. On the economy and budget, let's see what happens in Washington, D.C. But it's been so partisan and so bad over the last 6 months, I'm not sure there's going to be an answer there. So with that, I will turn it over to, on that cheery note, I'll turn it over to August.
I'll be Mr. Sunshine.
Thank you, General Cheney. And we do want to encourage everyone to take your notes, or you don't have to take notes, but definitely prepare some tough questions for the panel if you like. And we encourage you guys to start up some lively conversation at the end. Our next speaker, August Cole, is a writer and analyst specializing in national security issues and a member of our Young Professionals Network. He is an adjunct fellow at the American Security Project, and he focuses there on defense industry issues. He's also a senior analyst at Wikistrat, very innovative crowdsourced geopolitical analysis and forecasting group. And he's also a member of the International Institute for Strategic Studies. August.
Thank you. Thank you for coming and for taking an interest in this larger issue. I come at it through my background as a journalist, which focused on markets and then the defense industry when I was in Washington at the Wall Street Journal. And I left that to go make stuff up, to write fiction, really, but also to keep to go deeper into some of the policy questions that we're talking about tonight. The thing that is really, I think, important about this project and getting people like you in the room to be excited about it, too, is that we're at a crossroads where we've spent 10 years plus at war, and that period is ending. It's ending in the political sense. It's ending in the operational sense for much of the country. And so there's a question about what are we going to do next? You know, what do we want our country to be? You know, where will our values give us guidance? And I think a lot of the questions that I am wrestling with, and I think people are wrestling with this in academia, in industry, in government, is this very notion of direction. And what we see from our direction is not really very heartening, in that you look at rankings like Steve mentioned in the World Economic Forum, most recently, you know, placing us at around seventh, I believe, and that's down from first within, you know, less than 5 years. You know, Americans like to win, and, you know, and I think that you can look at this not in a jingoistic sense, but in a true sort of narrative. And as someone who's really bad at math, but likes to write and likes stories, I think the narrative of our direction as a country is really important, and competitiveness very much plays into that. And so what, you know, I hope to talk to you and I hope you can ask me about is, in fact, that, that notion of finding a new framework for understanding what makes us strong, but also what makes us weak. I think acknowledging the things that weaken us helps understand the how to not make the mistakes that imperil really our prosperity and hopefully an improving way of life. You know, Steve mentioned the way I've been looking at competitiveness, I've defined it really as, you know, our country's ability to lead globally on the strength of our actions and ideas, to support a vibrant free market system, to nurture a responsive democratic political system, and then to uphold a social contract that honors economic and social progress for its citizens. Individually, you may have differences with that, just as you may have differences with the elements that, that Steve mentioned as well, of what I see to be competitive. And that's part of what I hope to engender is a debate about those core elements, because we all see those from our different perspectives. And because this definition of national security is changing and therefore implying that our competitiveness is intertwined with it as I see it, you know, I want to talk a little bit about the way things were and the way I see things going. When I lived in Washington, D.C., you know, I got there in 2007 after living in Boston for a year, and it really felt like a boom town. And I've lived in boom towns like San Francisco during the 1990s and been part of the dot-com experience when I worked at a website called MarketWatch.com. You know, that is in large part because of a lot of the spending at the federal level on intelligence and defense and really just national security, upswing that D.C. had. It's a very, very peculiar feeling, and then the more you dive into the mechanisms of the budget around national security, you see how complicated and how some appearing intractable many of these issues are. But it kind of makes sense that D.C. feels like that because that was the character of the times in Washington. But I also see that as a definition of national security that's rooted in an old model. And since living in Boston now just over a year, I feel like there's a new definition that I'm talking about that I really start to see more of in this community here. You know, the surrounding area, Boston itself, the people here are engaged, whether it's with school, whether it's issues that are tied indirectly or directly to the country's competitiveness and therefore its national security. It's something I see literally in the literal sense with the defense industrial base around here, companies such as Raytheon. I see it in the Big Dig, you know, which is a sign of what infrastructure eventually can do to improve quality of life. I see it in the Cambridge corridor, in the high-tech work that just happens across the river from here, or the biopharma companies that are peppered throughout, the video game developers, you know, people that are really impacting how America projects its influence and power. Even in the kind of artisanal aspect of the economy around here, custom bike makers like a Company 7 in Watertown, all of that is individually add up to these different disparate elements of competitiveness that I'm talking about. When we look at many of these issues that are their individual elements, business, climate, infrastructure, debt, in D.C. we look at those in silos, and that's, I think, one of the big problems, that there is very little cross-discipline analysis, cross-discipline examination, and really introspection on the part of the leadership in those different worlds. And taking a holistic sense, and I don't mean holistic in the like patchouli and tie-dye sense, but a true holistic, you know, look at what makes us strong is part of what this effort is about, part of what ASP is trying to do, you know, even before this paper. And I think that's very rare in D.C. and something that should be happening more of. You know, I think one of the criticisms, you know, you can always make of someone who tries to tell you that an issue is a national security issue is like, really? Because we have seen a lot of that in the last decade of labeling things national security problems that really aren't. But I believe this really actually is one, this issue of competitiveness, because the way we project power, the way we are seen, our order of battle is not the true measure of that anymore. We are talking about all these other elements, you know. And so I think that when you think about the notion of the rankings that we talked about at the World Economic Forum level and how the business community sees us, obviously Jan is going to speak to this very specifically and from a point of view that is really complementary to the national security perspective, but you begin to see the sorts of work that lies ahead in changing not only policy, not only changing actual budget allocations to fund different types of research or defund programs that are really wasteful, But we're often talking about things that don't show up on a corporate income statement or in a blue book for the Pentagon. You're talking about attitudes, and those are really it sounds really corny, but those are some of the hardest things to change. But by I think each one of us thinking about these kinds of issues and using these frameworks to examine how you in your work now and in the future kind of fit into this larger picture of the country's competitiveness, of how it's able to project its power, how it's able to take care of the people that live here, I think it becomes a more rewarding and more participatory experience, which is really good for kind of the country, writ large. I think the intractability of the political dialogue in D.C. is something that is really, really frustrating for people that are fair-minded and, I think, reasonable adults. Sequestration was a threat. It's like I've got a 2-year-old and a 7-year-old, and you knew right away that sequestration wouldn't work. You can't threaten, people who are irrational and hungry all the time and tired. And we're in a week or so we're gonna see that play out, and it's really too bad. I mean, I personally believe we do need to cut the defense budget specifically in certain programs, but an across the board way to do it doesn't make any long term sense. And I'll stop here in a minute, but I think this notion of making sense for the long term is really important, because we're dealing with a very acute period of time right now in the next, not just week, but in the next, say, 12 to 18 months that will impact dramatically how our country fares in the next 50 years, maybe even 100. And I think that sort of weight and gravitas is missing from the debate. People with authority like Steve can really call folks out on that, but it's also owning up to our own responsibilities, particularly in Washington, I think, to what our role can be in making America more competitive and therefore a stronger country.
Thank you, August. Our third panelist is Professor Dan Rifkin, who is the Bruce V. Rauner Professor and Chair of the Strategy Unit at Harvard Business School. His research, course development, and teaching efforts examine the connections that link marketing, production, logistics, finance, human resources management, and the many parts of a firm, and he is going to use this expertise to help us delve into this issue from the private sector perspective and wherever else you'd like to take it.
Great. James, thank you. And I just want to thank Boston International and World Boston and have a few more words of gratitude to my co-panelists, August and Stephen, and Stephen particularly for your service. Thank you. I think it's important to acknowledge that every opportunity we have. I've had the privilege now of talking about U.S. competitiveness to a range of audiences. I think this is the first one that has been preceded by a liquor tasting. Usually the alcohol comes afterwards. Having listened to the sobering stories that all three of us are going to tell, I now think maybe it's wise to have the liquor tasting before. I think the American economy today really does stand at a crossroads. It's a word that August used. It's a kind of a crossroads between hope and doubt. And I do want to put the word out there for hope. There are reasons for hope. We've got a divisive election behind us. We have an economy that's growing while Europe struggles to avoid a second recession. We've got much of our innovation engine still humming along. We've got the prospect of low-cost energy for the next generation. There's a lot of good things going on. Then there's the problem of doubt. And I think for many people, the doubt centers around the sequester and the financial and fiscal theatrics we see in Washington, D.C. I actually would argue, though, that the fiscal situation of the U.S. government is more a symptom than a cause. A symptom of a longer and deeper challenge to U.S. competitiveness, a challenge that has been a generation in the making, a challenge that can be addressed, but if not addressed, will be a challenge and will hold back the economy for another generation. Stephen commented on the average age of the folks in the room. I think it's actually a perfect age, because you should think of yourselves as having a target on your back. If we don't solve these problems, it's exactly this age range that will bear the consequences. So I think there are reasons for both hope and doubt, but the doubt stems from this long-run challenge to U.S. competitors. That notion that we're facing really a long-term challenge, not the hangover of the financial crisis, not a bad recession, a slow recovery, but something structural, has been the dominant message of the U.S. Competitiveness Project out of Harvard Business School, which my colleague Mike Porter and I have had the chance to chair for the last 2 years. We've had about a dozen faculty members working on this, and I'll certainly stand on their shoulders. I always speak for myself, but I very much rely on their work. What I want to do is just share four quick ideas. I'll state them all up front. I want to go deeply into two of them because I want to turn us over to discussion and follow your energy very quickly. The first idea is we can make progress on U.S. competitiveness only if we first define what we mean by the term well. So I'll come back to that. The second one is the notion of the structural challenge that I think if we define it properly, we'll find that, in fact, there has been a problem that's a couple decades in the making, and I'll try to give a narrative about what I think the basic structure of the problem's been. The third idea is that there's a role to be played by both government and the private sector in solving this problem. On the government side, there actually is a shockingly clear consensus on the fundamental things that need to get done. And the really interesting mystery there, as you step back, is how are we not making progress, right? When I think people across the political spectrum, when you talk to them behind closed doors on a range of important topics, will say, yeah, we actually really should do that. And the fourth message, and this to me is actually the one of greatest hope, is, you know, many people think of competitiveness as the government's problem, that basically policymakers should solve this problem and that businesses should fundamentally simply, you know, maximize profit. That's what they're up to. I'm going to argue that, to the contrary, there is a fundamental role for business to play in addressing and restoring U.S. competitiveness. And in fact, that's where a lot of the hope comes from, that the bad news is I don't think the answers will issue forth from Washington. The good news is they don't have to. So let me just say a word about the first two, the definition of competitiveness and the structural problem, and the roots of that. And I'll leave the role of government and the role of business as something we could discuss as the conversation unfolds. So definition. Faculty can fight over definitions forever, and in fact, we did a lot. But we ultimately came to the following point of view, that the U.S. is the competitive location to the extent that firms here can do two crucial things. First, succeed in the international global marketplace, and second, raise the living standards of the average American. And the second part of that definition, the living standards part, is often lost in the conversation. You often hear people say things like, you know, the U.S. would be more competitive if only wages here were lower. And it's true that if wages were lower, we would find it easier for firms to succeed in the global marketplace. But that can't be competitiveness. If we have to take a national pay cut in order to sell our goods abroad, that can't be a sign we're competitive. That's a sign that we are not competitive. Competitive nations manage to do both. The firms succeed, but so do the citizens. And the only way you do that is by making the U.S. a wildly productive place to make goods. Now, that means that ultimately competitiveness hinges on making the place just tremendously productive, right? It's only through productivity can you both have firms succeed and have citizens succeed as well. So this brings me to the second idea, you know, the structural issue. What's going on? Why do we have a problem with U.S. competitiveness? And in fact, in our efforts to understand this, we've surveyed our alumni, 10,000 last year, another 7,000 this year, 1,000 members of the general public. And they come back with a very strong point of view that by that definition of competitiveness, the ability of firms to compete but also raise living standards, we've got a problem. So where is the problem? Where does it come from? It's very complex, I think, but let me try to give a basic narrative and see if it resonates with the group. The narrative starts with an idea. The idea is that of a commons, that any business draws from a certain set of common goods that we all share in order to be productive. Every business needs a vibrant network of suppliers, an educated populace, a pool of skilled labor, rule of law, decent infrastructure, and that historically in the U.S., the government and business collaborated to build a very, very rich commons that made the U.S. the most productive nation the world has ever seen. But then starting probably somewhere in the 1980s, a number of dynamics began to basically undermine that collaboration. And it started, ironically, I think, with one of the great victories of Western capitalism, the knockout blow that Adam Smith landed on Karl Marx, right? Somewhere in the 1980s, that led to the decline of traditional communism. And the opening of the world for business. It became possible to do business from anywhere to anywhere. That led to, and that was all changes in geopolitics, changes in technology. That led to some great things for our economy, wonderful things for shareholders, wonderful things for consumers, but it also tended to weaken the connections between companies and their communities. And the investments that companies had made in that commons, it started to withdraw to some extent. In addition, this change put enormous pressure on our middle class that found itself suddenly in intense competition with hundreds of millions of skilled, ambitious workers around the world. And you can see it in the data. You can see household income stagnate around then. You can see wages no longer tracking increases in productivity. You can see the number of jobs in the sectors of the economies exposed to international competition, growth in those sectors going to absolute zero net. Now, how did we as a society respond to these pressures on our middle class? One response could have been, we doubled down to make the middle class able to compete against all the forces that are out there, to make the middle class highly productive. But I don't think that's what we did by and large. By and large, and I think we can blame Democrats, Republicans, private sector, public sector, all of us for this. Basically, we tried to maintain for a long time the illusion of prosperity by making a series of unsustainable promises to most of our society. Promises like, please don't worry about your stagnant income. We'll extend additional credit to you. Please go out and consume, particularly consume houses. Promises like the government will increasingly fund your health care costs in your retirement. Promises like the government will directly employ you. And by the way, we'll do all of this without raising your taxes. And you take all those promises, you couple them with two wars and a nasty recession, and you wind up with a government which doesn't have the resources then to invest in many of the things that has made the commons very healthy in the U.S. historically. And so you couple that with a kind of footloose private sector and a hobbled government, fiscally hobbled government, and you ask yourself, who is investing in the infrastructure, the individuals, the innovation, the institutions required to keep building that commons? And you wind up with a commons that is very much run down. Now, that is a sobering story. I think there is hope, perhaps on the federal policy side, and perhaps on the side of what business can do, and in fact, already is beginning to do to restore that commons. But I'll leave that for our discussion, because I think I want to get a sense of where the energy in the room lies.
With that, sir.
Sure, if I may. Well, thank you all. Amazing to have you all on the same stage, and really appreciate it. My question was, I guess, sort of a different take and a little bit more looking inward domestically about apathy and engagement. I use the word engagement as just such a catch-all sort of these days. And I have the good fortune with my work at World Boston to host a lot of international visitors. And, you know, you see people around the world fighting so hard for any sort of voice in the political system. I'm able to share some of the great democratic institutions we have, which give people access. And yet you see so much of this frustration, even when it boils down to affecting people on a day-to-day basis, not always manifested in actually exerting real pressure in Washington, D.C. for something as such a no-brainer as sequestration. So I'm kind of wondering on your take as far as, is apathy, you know, maybe a bigger risk as far as our own internal politics, where we have this great system and accessibility, and I think people have information, but are not yet motivated to act until maybe the lights go out, and what will it take? Something major like that, or, you know, a bridge crumbling, massive layoffs, something really striking. So I'd like to get your take on that. Thank you again.
Jan, you want to do that first?
Yeah, I mean, my response to apathy is, you're all here tonight. I'm actually, I'd be very concerned about apathy, but personally, I'm not seeing it. We've had the privilege in our work to go out city to city, kind of sharing the word, and we've got hundreds of people showing up at each event around the country. I see enormous energy in the business community on this. You just say U.S. competitiveness, and people will show up, and they'll start to move. We do events in New York, and we literally have alumni come up afterwards, starting efforts to, you know, get community colleges aligned with employers to get students into good jobs over time. So I actually, I don't know if I'm going to be the Pollyanna on this group, but I
no doubt.
I see a lot of energy.
We need it.
Yeah, I mean, I see apathy.
I think apathy can easily come from frustration, of which there is a lot of, and rightfully so. I think to reverse that takes time, and with the same sort of impatience that you see it demonstrated in the political leadership community, which is frustrating, you know, acquiring that patience in the general sense is hard, again, when you're frustrated. But we're talking about reversing something over years, not months. But that's often, you know, the responsibility of leadership. And I think Steve, you know, sees this firsthand down south.
Yeah, I sympathize with what you were saying. And no doubt about it, my take is a lot different from yours, Janet. Yeah. So the politics now are so acidic in Washington. And not to get too much into details, but you look at the popularity of Congress, and they say it's one of the lowest ranked, et cetera, et cetera. But if you go to that individual congressman's district where he or she was elected by a majority, they're looking out for their district. They're not looking out for the country. And the problem with that is, of course, there might not be a confluence of interests there. That what's best for their district might not be the best of what's for the country. Less so on the Senate side of the House, because they're elected by state, for starters, and they're elected for 6 years. So it's interesting, and I deal with both sides of the Hill frequently, and the other side of it, too. In the House, there's a lot more turnover, and there's a big education gap here. So I see a lot of people from my perspective who just sit there and go, there's answers to each one of these problems.
Yeah.
I mean, there are rational answers, and you wouldn't be here if you weren't educated, interested people, and I really, really, really appreciate that. No offense, but there's a lot of Americans that aren't, and just can't get their grips around it, and they can't relay that importance to the Capitol Hill and to the Congress. Now, I understand business, and, you know, businessmen's running it to have a viable business and work and get things going, but a lot of times on the Hill, I just don't see that sense of optimism that you're talking about, and it gets put into politics, and it's ugly, and it's really ugly now. And like I said, but there are answers. I could get into answers for each one of the things I proposed there. If you talk the word tax, people go crazy. Grover Norquist's office is across the street from mine. It's amazing the influence that this guy has. But I'll put a good idea out here for the Republican side. Lower the corporate tax rate. I mean, don't you think that would get people pretty excited? You know, but you can't talk that. The Democrats don't like that. Raise the gas tax. Oh, Jesus! I mean, that, you know, you would think that people, you know, if you're using the roads, you ought to be paying to use those roads. Go to Europe and buy a gallon of gas and see how much it costs. These are all rational answers, but either one of those two things I just mentioned is non-starters on the Hill. So, does that answer your question, or give you? There's a hopeful one.
Part of my hopefulness is I don't think we have to wait for Washington. I agree with you. Everyone I talk to about Washington, they all say the same thing. The line, almost the line, the language is the same. I've never seen it this bad. But do we have to wait?
Well, you're making it feel a little bit better.
There's a lot of exciting stuff happening city by city, region by region. So,
yeah. Well, you're making me feel a little bit better. But again, I look at the clientele that you took your survey from. These are Harvard-educated businessmen and women.
Though we did the general public this year as well, and what was shocking was the degree of consensus between business leaders and the general public on where our greatest problems lie, and even on the policy side.
Well, that's heartening.
Yeah.
It is. I appreciate those comments. Did we stimulate? Yes, sir.
So I think so much of the gridlock is because of this massive polarization of Washington, where in a given election, only so many seats are actually really up for election because of a lot of the, you know, some of these districts are so gerrymandered, they can really only go Republican or Democrat.
Sure.
And there's only so many electoral votes that are really in play in a given presidential election. And you look at a lot of the other developed countries like the UK and Germany and they all have really vibrant, you know, 3 or 4 party systems. How realistic do you think it is that in, you know, the near future we'll have a legitimate third party in this country?
Oh, Lord. You know, you might have got one with the Tea Party and the business going on in Republicans, but it might not be the party you want. I mean, they're killing themselves, not to betray any of my party affiliations here, but, you know, the Tea Party is fighting the rest of the Republican Party, and you got Rand Paul and that whole business going on. You're close to having a third party there. Of course, now the flip to that is, the Republican Party is going to go, we better get our act together, or the Democrats are going to be kicking our ass for the next 4 years. So that's going to ameliorate some of that. If you're talking a genuine third party that will be more centrist, in my opinion, rational, I don't hold much hope for it. I'd be August.
I think a lot of that will come down to money. As much of the political machine in terms of putting people forth as candidates depends on an extraordinary amount of money, more than ever. And I think unless you find people who are willing to, you know, support that at a grassroots level to give it credibility, it's fairly unlikely.
Do you think it'd be top down or bottom up?
I think it would have to be bottom up to be credible and successful. I think if it's top down, you would get some of the negative optics, I'll call them, that the Tea Party has dealt with and aspects of the Republican Party, because they've been supported by groups that have business interests aligned with values that are out of step to some extent with kind of the reasonable road.
Jan?
So your comment on the third party opens the door to pretty substantial innovations in our democracy. And one of the kind of neat things about what we have had the chance to do is we've exposed about 50,000 HBS alumni to these ideas and concerns, and you get a lot of ideas back. And some of them are a little off the wall, but one came in that I'll share with you. I'm going to put it to a vote in this group just to market test it, from one of our alums who was very creative. The first line made me think, okay, this is not going anywhere. It said, I'd like to propose a constitutional amendment. I immediately said, keep your hands off my constitution, right? But here was the idea. And there's certain, not just stupid, I think there's a certain wisdom in it. The idea was a public check on Congress, so that every 10 years, there would be an up-down vote on all of Congress, okay? And if Congress can't mount a, like, 25% approval rating from the public, a clock starts to tick. A clock starts to tick for a year. And after a year, there's another vote. And if they still can't get a 25% approval rating from the country, one-third of Congress is removed. Probably the most senior portion. It's not clear what the right one-third is. But the idea here is to get beyond commitment to just your district.
It's like the Hunger Games for long time.
We're voting off the island, August.
I love it.
But the notion that, you know, it's not a third party, but it is a, you know, can we get something really... How many of you would actually... a handful, you'd endorse that kind of constitutional...
Not as described, but something along
those lines. Okay, so how many of you are willing to do something that radical from where we are to get out the gridlock? Wow. It certainly speaks to the level of desperation.
Yes, sir.
Well, I'm just interested in something maybe, you know, as radical as that, but on the other side, is providing some sort of immunity, you know freezing, instead of the gridlock that comes with the churn from being up for election, literally, in the House of Congress, from the minute you're elected, you're up for re-election again, because it's a two-year cycle, for extending that term and providing some of the benefits that go to the Senate side, which you have a six-year term, and giving some latitude for members of Congress to focus on the people's business rather than re-election, right. and pandering to the businesses who provide the funding for their campaign and trying to get some work done. You know, what about going, you know, kind of radicalizing but going in that direction?
What form of immunity, by the way?
Well, I just, in terms of extending the term limit beyond 2 years.
You mean like giving them breathing room so they can make different decisions that aren't bound, right?
towards fundraising and immediately kicking back into that election cycle and working on the business at hand.
I mean, when they study how much time a member spends on fundraising, it's, you know, essentially the part of your day you're actually, you know, paying attention. which is to say, you know, about half of it. I mean, I think one of the things that is most interesting about living and working in Washington, and particularly when you skulk around Capitol Hill or in the kind of, you know, bowels of the Pentagon, is you find out who really does a lot of the work, you know, and it's people just like you, you know, not much older.
Staffers.
Yeah, you know, it's young lawyers, young people who are zealots politically, young people who just believe in the country. You know, it's folks that are quite motivated for really the right reasons, doing much of the heavy lifting. And I take heart in that. At first, you're shocked, and you're a little bit floored by that kind of a revelation, but then you're heartened as well, because you know that if you can reach people who have a vested interest in doing their jobs well for different stakes, that you can affect change, that you can make a bigger difference.
This issue of spending all your time raising money for the next election is a real one. I speaking with one of the newly elected members of Congress about how he was spending his day, and he was complaining about the amount of time spent on this, and I pointed him to Larry Lessig's book that goes to notions of trying to get campaign finance reform and so forth. And I said, have you read it? And he said, where would I find time to read it? And my thought was, that's exactly why you need to read it. All right?
I think that is an avenue, you know, to your point about dramatic, you know, reinvention of term limits or even the culling the herd, if you will. Yeah. I think on the finance, I think keeping a more conservative, I don't mean conservative in the Republican sense, but a more traditional approach to the construct of our representative democracy, but really fundamentally altering the financial dynamics would really be the path where we could see long-term success.
Yes, sir.
Some of the symptoms that you describe in particular, about dropping down in these various metrics or indicators of competitiveness, are all consistent within the corporate world, where the goals of any company start to become unclear or start to fall apart, and you have different parts of the company or functions heading off in their own directions and different management heading off in their own directions. It causes a company to fall down in multiple dimensions simultaneously. And so what we seem to be seeing here at Congress is a massive battling over strategies, which is probably the wrong battle to have. And your colleague Michael Porter has a very good model. He has the model, the Four Corners model, which is for
diamond model, right?
No, that the diamond is for comparative advantage of nations.
Okay.
And then he has the Five Forces model for industries.
Yep.
And he has another one called the Porter Four Corners model for companies. And it's in display, it has the four corners are, the first one is goals, the second one is assumptions, the third one are capabilities, and the fourth one is strategies. And strategies are just a result of these other ones. And when you have such fighting over goals and assumptions, then by nature these strategies look like they came out of a higgledy-piggledy machine. And so how do we get, and Obama attempted a few clear goals. He had a goal for healthcare and he had a goal for education. How do we just get these folks down to picking a few goals? Because if the goals are set, it's almost like the goals aren't even set. How do you pick a few goals and then everybody can focus on what to be, how to be competitive on? But it seems like there's no one dimension that any business can rely on in this country at this point on what dimension we're going to be competitive on. So what do you think, maybe I'll put it to you guys, are the two or three, or maybe the one key must-have goal that if everybody signed up for, we can start the journey towards competitiveness?
I think immigration reform is a big one, and one that the business community would relate to in a favorable way, but also the general public.
Got to get our hands on the debt. You know, you've got to do something about this economy. It plays into entitlements. Nobody wants to touch entitlements. Talk about the target on the back. I'm 63. I'm going to be the lucky guy in this group because I'm going to get my Social Security. You aren't going to get yours unless we do something about it. and we ought to be raising the age for Social Security. We ought to be raising the age for retirement. Looking real hard at Medicare, Medicaid. You know, I understand Obamacare and that whole business. It was a nice try. I don't think it quite did the job. And then you got to look at government spending. All of those put together, you can reduce. There are you can reduce the debt, and we can get back on the right footing here. But I think that, but each one of those topics is such a hot topic in D.C. that nobody wants to go there. Sequestration was kind of a, you know, they planned sequestration as kind of the hammer. Okay, you guys better do something, or we're going to hammer yourselves with it. They Congress passed sequestration, so it's their own fault. They're blaming Obama now. Well, it was a team effort, I would say. Okay, there's a lot of talk yesterday and today about let's let it go. Let's see what happens. And I think that's going to happen. And it might go for a day or two, and there might be some loud screams, and then maybe, just maybe, it'll be enough for them to do something about it. But anyway, that would be my thought.
So if you're really talking about goals, I think it's actually, in a sense of not what first program you do, but what's the goal. The goal is high and rising productivity. That's the only way that any nation has ever been able to both sell its goods successfully in international markets and also raise the living standards of its people. Otherwise, you're selling them by reducing the living standards. So that's pretty clear. The problem is that an enormous number of things go into driving national productivity. And there is no silver bullet. Just isn't. We could each pick our first, you know, the thing we'd most want to get done, the things we most think can't get done, but no silver bullet.
I do think that progress begets progress.
Yeah. So which one do you start with? If there was one that, like you picked immigration, for example, okay. If people left this room and wanted to do one thing tomorrow, and maybe it's just start with supporting a closure on the immigration vote,
right.
And great. Then you pick off something else. But what help is your organization in particular? Is there a ranked list of a sequence in which you're advocating?
Like an algorithm of...
Is there a sequence in which we could start focusing and supporting these things one by one so the dominoes start falling in the right order? Yeah. I think rather than... You're again putting out... It sounded like you guys described the menu. You have six things on the menu. I was like, I need a sequence. Right.
I don't know if you could get a functional algorithm. I mean, just because of the nature of...
Is your organization willing to take a point of view?